Hey, what's up, guys? This is Deion Brown, and you are listening to Man vs. Brand. We are really excited for the episode that we have today. We oftentimes find ourselves talking to individuals who have a diverse background, right? So you have folks that came into the business in one space and then entered into a new business. And that's great, right? That's great for being multidisciplined, for following what your passion is in life. But the question is, how do we really fund that, right? How do we fund the life that we ultimately want? And how does your passion become something that is not a burden, but a joy? And for me, being joyous is somewhere in the foundation of financial literacy, right? For me, I am my happiness when my money's working for me, when I have passive streams of income that are making more money than I thought they would. That's amazing to me. That's when I'm in my best life. Now, there are some skills to that. It's not just something that you happen on. It's not something that just occurs. It's something that you have to approach with some level of strategy. We know that because we know that most people who win ginormous amounts of money in the lottery tend to lose it because they're not aware of their tax liabilities, their tax responsibilities. They don't understand investment in a way that allows them to get a real return. And we don't want to be those people. We as entrepreneurs don't want to be the guys who made the money, but just didn't know how to invest it properly, didn't understand tax at a high level. And listen, I'm not going to advocate for you guys to be specialists. I'm not going to say that you need to go out there and become your own tax attorneys. I'm not going to say that you should be your own accountants, but you should have some good idea of some sound strategy. And if nothing else, you should know, is the guy sitting across the table from you really on top of their shit? Anyway, I'm going to talk to an expert who I think might have some of the speaking points that you need to have an intelligent conversations with your trusted advisors around your money, your taxes, and your investment. Stay tuned. We're coming up with this episode in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
One of the greatest philosophers of our time once said that when it's up, then it's stuck. Find out how to make your next big idea stick with Deion Brown and his podcast. With 20 years of experience in growing and managing businesses and brands at the highest level, Deion is having the conversations that you are looking for. Welcome and have a great time.
All right, guys, so I want to introduce to you my guest for today. So I'm going to be talking to Bronson Hill. Now, Bronson is a managing partner at Bronson Equity. Now, we're going to talk to him about what that looks like. What does that mean? You know, I don't really know. I want him to explain that to you. But I want to talk about the skill sets that he comes to this podcast with. So not only is he a podcaster himself with a pretty awesome podcast, guys, I've listened to it. Again, I'm going to let him talk to you about that. But he also comes with some very clear conversation and speaking points as it relates to investments and taxes. So without any further ado, I'm going to shut up and I'm going to let Bronson introduce himself to you guys and state why he thinks he should be talking to you about your money and your investments. Bronson, what's going on, buddy?
Hey, Deion, great to be here. Love the intro, man. That was awesome. And I think everything you said is right on, right? Because you can make all the money you want, and it's not really about how much you make, it's how much you keep and how long you keep it for and how hard it works for you. So I think, I talk a lot to individuals about passive investing. I've interviewed over the last several years, 1,200 millionaires. And just ask lots of questions about their goals. Why are they doing certain things? And really how to get more involved in passive investing. And I have a company where we buy apartment buildings, large apartment buildings, and we give people opportunities to invest alongside of us. So that's my business. I also have a As you mentioned, I have the Mailbox Money Show, which is on, it's a show on YouTube as well as on iTunes and wherever you find podcasts. And it's just basically dedicated to help people that are entrepreneurs, that are wealthy. How do I save on taxes? How do I make more money? How do I do things outside of Wall Street? Because I was an investment advisor for several years, and I came to the conclusion that I don't think Wall Street actually serves people. There's a lot of hidden fees. They make sure they get paid at Wall Street, but they don't necessarily always do the right thing for the investor. So I've got a lot of opinions about all those things. I'd love to kind of take it whatever direction you want to go, but I'm very excited to be here on your show.
Thank you. Thank you. So let's start with one of your early points, because I think that I want to clarify this for folks, right? So in speaking to the folks that you've spoken to on your podcast, right, and finding the strategies and discussing the strategies necessary for people to retain more of their wealth, right? You don't really have to be wealthy to start these strategies, right? Like, this is something that you should really be thinking about before you make your first million, so that you're coming into your first million with a sound strategy. Would you agree to that?
Yeah, I think, you know, really it's interesting. A lot of times there's this idea of be, do, have. So a lot of times we just simply start with the have. Like, I just want to have money. I just want to have a lot of wealth. And you gave the example of a lottery winner, right? And a lot of people that win lottery, only 11% of people that win the lottery 5 years later say that their life is better off since they won, right? Because they lose it, they have problems, they don't know how to structure it, they don't know how to do the taxes, they don't need this stuff. Most people end up losing it, or a lot of people end up losing it. So the idea is you want to start with the end in mind. So to become a wealthy person, it's not just having wealth, it's you start to actually become wealthy in your mindset. So you try to get around, this is what I learned, is you get around people that are wealthy and you learn what are the habits that they have around money. How do they think about taxes? How do they think about inflation? How do they invest? And then by doing those things, then you can have what they have. But it starts with the mindset. It starts with the vision. It starts with the, you know, why do I want to have this wealth? And when I have it, you know, what kind of person do I need to be? And what are the actions I need to do to be able to sustain that? So that's kind of the process, rather than just starting with having. A lot of people are more victim mentality. I won't get $1 million unless somebody gives me $1 million, unless somebody dies and I inherit $1 million. But the idea of actually becoming somebody who's wealthy, it's not what you have, it's who you are. And then out of that, you do the actions of somebody who's wealthy, and then you have the wealth. So it's a subtle but a very significant thing that I've noticed with people that are wealthy, is that they start with becoming the person.
And it's also true, I believe, that when we look at the spectrum of wealth, not everyone, there are a few people that inherited positions that allowed them to gain and acquire wealth, but you often find that folks really started with scarce means, right? And so you had to have at some point imagine this life for yourself, right? And approach that future with some level of intent, right? Of a mindset of abundance, a mindset of wealth, in order for you to earn a dollar and then realize the best use of that dollar for it to make you more money, right? Isn't that the philosophy? Or am I wrong? I could be wrong. I'm okay if I'm wrong.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, going back to the idea of scarcity and abundance, I mean, I came from a very middle-class family. My dad, everybody's in education. My dad, my mom, my grandmother, everybody's in education. And so, you know, a lot of times it's actually, to be an entrepreneur versus being an educator, they're very opposite type of things. And I just did a presentation at a conference recently about kind of the millionaire mindset. And a lot of people don't realize this, that when you look at how many millionaires actually inherited it, it's actually way smaller than you think. It's 88% of millionaires are self-made, which is, I think, just a staggering statistic. That means almost 9 out of 10 people that are millionaires today, they did not inherit it. They did not come from means. They learned this stuff on their own. So to me, like, I did not come from means at all. I worked my way up kind of at the corporate world a little bit. I became a medical sales guy. I'd go into surgery and I'd sell stuff. I started doing single family houses, which I thought was great. But then it was very difficult to scale and to get bigger. And so through that process, I met an individual who said, hey, why don't you do this thing called syndication, where you use other people's money and you can scale. And so if you're an entrepreneur, whatever your business is, is the idea of scaling a business is really, really important. For me, if you ask this question, is it easier to double the size of your income or to go 10x? Most people would say it's easier to double, but I would say, and this is a guy named Dan Sullivan, who has an entrepreneurs group, talks about this. He says it's actually easier to 10x the size of your business. And the reason why is because if you're doubling the size, you're having to work twice as hard. You've got to do what you do for twice as many hours. You got to do twice as much to get there. If it's 10 times, you've got to let go of about 90% of the stuff you were doing and find a way to scale to grow bigger. So I do think it is a mindset, but I think it starts with just, you know, dealing with the self-limiting beliefs and really trying to figure out, you know, what's step number one and how do I want to get there?
All right, cool. So you mentioned this idea of doubling your money versus earning 10 times as much, right? Or 10X, as you put it, right? So what that sounds like to me is functioning in this kind of Pareto principle space, right? Where in order to earn 10 times the amount, you have to figure out what the 20% of your activities are that actually yield the most results, right? And then leverage out everything else to everyone else so you can focus on the things that are not only dollar producing, but produce the most and max amount of dollars possible, right?
Right. Yeah, so I think that's really the issue, right? It's when you're an entrepreneur, if you're a younger entrepreneur, you don't exactly know what you don't know. And there's a reason why 80% of small businesses fail within 5 years and 96% are closed within 10 years of starting. We just don't know what the right things are to do. So how do we figure that out? And I think in the beginning, it's just trying lots of different things. It's trying to figure out, you know, what's going to work, what doesn't work. There's an author named Robert Kiyosaki who wrote the book Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And he wrote a book called Before You Leave Your Job. And it's a great book. And it basically talks about as an employee, you can't make mistakes, because if you make mistakes, you'll get fired. You make too many mistakes, you'll get fired. Well, as an entrepreneur, you have to make a lot of mistakes, be willing to make mistakes, and quickly learn what works, what doesn't work, what do I need to do more of, what do I need to stop doing. And the people that can learn and adapt the quickest and to the market, and to the need, those are the people that make it. Those are the people that have amazing companies, because they may start out with one thing, but they end up somewhere else amazing. I don't know if you know this, YouTube itself was started basically, it was the first kind of video broadcasting site. It started as a dating site or a dating app that you would basically get on there and do video. And then they realized all these other people were going on there and doing other types of videos that had nothing to do with dating. So they switched it, right? Everything shifted and changed. So it's being willing to adapt and try new things, continue to look at the market, look at what you're doing, and just continuing to try to grow.
All right, cool, man. So let's talk a little bit about your journey into the multifamily. I'm going to let you tell the story. I'm going to let you tell the story of how you got in the space, but let me framework it. So I'm trying to think through kind of how I want to position this conversation. So a little background, a lot of my audience knows this, but I came from real estate, did about 15 years of working in the new dev, single family, multifamily space, ended up as an executive at Keller Williams in New York, all that great stuff, right? So I know a lot of agents are listening to this podcast, and they want to move from being real estate transaction management folks to becoming investors and players in the game. Right now, New York, you're in LA, right? So let me just framework this for you guys. So it's not like we're talking to Idaho. Love Idaho. Listen, Idaho's amazing, right? But it's not really apples to apples, right? And so we're talking about LA. We're going to talk about where your investments are. But this isn't a conversation of someone who doesn't understand the complexities of multifamilies in an environment where there is diversity among price points. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I think, like you said, if a lot of realtors, and my background is in sales as well. I worked for 10 years where I was doing a transactional-based business, right? I sold a lot of stuff, similar to how a realtor sells a lot of houses, and then you make money. But what happens if you stop selling? What happens if the market turns? What happens if you can't sell? well, then you don't make money because it was based on a transaction. Flipping is very similar. It's a transaction type of business. Now, when you invest passively in a multifamily deal, or even if you have a rental house or something, it can become a long-term investment. The challenge sometimes with single family rentals is that they can take a lot of work and they don't always produce a lot of cash flow. So multifamily deals, we typically see, we're buying a lot in Jacksonville, Florida. Love that market. We've got 1,000 units there, kind of value add multifamily, which just means we come in and we do renovations. Goal is to improve the asset over a five-year period. There's some tax benefits to do it. But I will say this, we talked a little bit earlier about taxes. There is a way for realtors, for a lot of realtors, to basically pay zero taxes. And a lot of people don't know this. So this is anybody working in real estate. There's something that the IRS has called the real estate professional designation. And what it allows you to do is to take passive losses in your investments and apply them against ordinary income. So an example, let's say if somebody makes $100,000 and they invest, let's just say $100,000 in a multifamily deal, and they can have $100,000 year one of passive losses on paper. There's some laws that change that you allow you to do this. Then you can basically use that against your ordinary income to reduce your taxes to zero. Now, again, I'm not giving anybody any specific advice, but it's something that's in the tax code that's very unique, and it's something I've used the last few years. So anyway, the idea of getting into an asset, becoming passive, or you can do it yourself, get into the asset, raise money, or find a deal. There's different ways to get involved in that. But one of the things I love about it is that you can pay little or no taxes, which is awesome.
Awesome, man. So question, why Jacksonville, Florida versus in your own backyard?
Right. Yeah. So I live in LA. You know, to buy a house here, you know, the neighborhood I live in is about 1.5 million to rent. And I actually currently rent. I mean, people say, why do you own 200 million in real estate in Florida and Georgia and you rent? Well, the reason why is if I bought this house, it would cost about 1.5 million. I'd have to put 10% down probably. And my payment would probably be around $7,000 or more. So I'd be paying twice as much to own the house than it is to rent. Now, there are other areas that we call cash flow positive, where they're experiencing population growth. Now, New York and LA are not experiencing population growth. They're actually experiencing population decline. So you have also things in New York and LA like rent control, where you cannot raise rents at will as you like. So we look for areas where we see population growth, job growth, income growth, landlord friendly, meaning you actually can kick people out if they don't pay, which the city of Los Angeles said you can't kick anybody out due to COVID till June of 2023. So a lot of people are just kind of dying their owners here. And then also think areas that are business friendly. So all of those things are in Jacksonville. It's affordable. You can still buy a decent house for $300,000. Every retiree or person that moves there due to COVID and can work remotely, they want to, you know, live more free, they can do it there. And then there's just a lot of people moving to those areas, to that area as well. So it's kind of a phenomenon that's happening. If you can work remotely and instead of living in New York City and paying $1 million for a studio apartment that you buy, you can get a 5,000 square foot house in Jacksonville and live really, really well, right? So it's a pretty, for a lot of people, I mean, they can't move, but for some people they can, and a lot more people are moving.
Got it. So how are you prospecting these deals? Like are you looking at the market, just doing like a mass look? Are you in LoopNet looking at commercial deals, trying to figure it out? Like, What becomes some of the criteria in your prospecting, in your search, that really identifies that it potentially is a good deal outside of the ones that you've mentioned, right? So outside of maybe churn, outside of landlord laws, outside of those things, what are some key indicators for an area or a city that might actually be advantageous?
Yeah. So when looking at a certain city, you know, like you talked about the population migration, how many people are moving there, how much was the available housing? Jacksonville has a 97% occupancy right now. So it just means there's very little available housing. There's nowhere for people to go. It's on a more local level, how we find deals is we look at a lot of deals. We look closely at them. We look at the numbers. We see what makes sense. We got our first property in Jacksonville a little over a year ago. And then since then, the amazing thing, as you know, being in real estate, it's not always a fair, equal playing field, right? It's an insider's game, particularly in the commercial space. So, when you own a property, let's say you've just closed on, we closed on our first property that was 288 units in Jacksonville. Now we're a player in that market. And so brokers are bringing us deals and we're finding stuff that's off market. About 80% of large multifamily deals over 100 units go off market. They don't even make it to market. And you think, well, why is that? Right? When you want the highest price possible? And the answer is no, not always, because the broker wants the most sure thing that's likely to close. Otherwise, somebody can tie up a property for 3 to 5 months and maybe it doesn't even sell. So it doesn't go to the highest offer often, and it often does not go to market. So now we actually have a seller that we have a good relationship with who's in the process of selling off their portfolio. And we're buying places where rents on average are $900, and we're seeing, you know, post-renovation upside of around $1,425 for rent. That's like a 50% upside, right? So that's what we like about Jacksonville. That's what we like about the properties that we're getting. They're a little bit older. We're able to renovate. So again, it's not a fair game, but it's just the way that it works, right? The more you're in an area, the more leads really come to you.
Nice, man. So let's stop talking about business for a second, because my audience is going to get tired of the stuff. They're learning, they're taking notes, but they want to know a little bit more about you. So talk to me, man. What are you passionate about? Like, what wakes you up and guides your day? What are you passionate about, Bronson, today?
Yeah, so there's a lot of things I'm passionate about. I think it's just about trying to live life to the fullest, right? We're here for a reason. We're here for a purpose. For me, a big defining purpose is being a great dad. I have a daughter who's 9. I want to be a great dad to Ellie. I love traveling. I love, you know, experiencing new things. My big why, kind of at the bottom of all that, is I'm really passionate about fighting human trafficking. I heard a story that really just kind of broke my heart. It was a couple of years ago where it was this girl who, you know, we don't realize that there's actually 20 to 40 million human slaves today. So slavery is not something that ended 150, 200 years ago. It's actually, there's more slaves in the world than there ever been in the history of the world. And so it's an uncomfortable thing. There's sexual human slavery, there's labor slavers, all kinds of things. But this girl was being rescued out of Greece. And one of the person who was telling this story started to say, hey, this, you know, there's more to the story. But she said when this girl realized she was being rescued, she just, with tears in her eyes, said to this person, like, well, why didn't you come sooner? And my friend said, well, we didn't come sooner because we didn't know you're here. But now that we know you're here, or there's girls like you, we're going to do everything we possibly can to help others. And so to me, something in me just really, Dion, just kind of broke in that moment where I said, this is a cause that's worth living and dying for. So it's not like, I guess I walk with that at every moment of every day, but you know, for me, financial freedom means helping people like this girl. It means having freedom over my time. It means really doing things that I find meaningful. And, you know, kind of, again, starting with the why, like, why am I here? Why am I taking up space on this earth? And it might be a little deep for a podcast, but I think it's really important to think about.
So you haven't listened to this podcast then. So this is actually what we do. This is okay. This is actually our spot, right? So
nice.
So we're gonna dive into that a little more, because that's where this podcast really went. All right. So there's this story or a circumstance where a young girl is found in Greece. You mentioned that that the person who was a part of the rescue team/organization was a friend, right? And so you're connected to a person whose a mission, or at least some facet of their mission, is to help rescue individuals that are trapped in some level of human trafficking. I'm doing this in a very broad way because I don't know the specifics, so I don't want to make these jumps in logic around what's actually happening. So trying to keep it broad and light, right? So you hear this story, and I know I hear stories like this, right? So what resonated with you at this particular time about this particular story?
Yeah. So I think really for me, it was, you know, being a dad, having a daughter, even the context of this girl, she's from North Africa, and her parents think they're sending her to Europe to go get a job. And it's like, she has this horrific time along the way and ends up gets where she's going and just is in this life of total bondage, and no one knows she's there. And so a lot of times we think of like the movie Taken, you know, right? Like the dad is out there and he's doing everything he can, but that's very, very minimal cases like that where somebody's kind of kidnapped, whatever. It's a very subversive, and there's all sorts of systems of, you know, it's difficult. But I think for me, it was just thinking about my daughter, right? Thinking about Ellie. If something happened to Ellie, there's no limit to what I would do to try to help her, right? There's no limit. Are you a parent, Dion?
I'm not. No, I do not have that luxury and honor quite yet. I'm working on it, though. It's a work in progress.
So those that are parents, I mean, it's just, there's something that happens where you just, in a moment, you do anything. You die for your child in a second. It's not even a thing. If there was a choice between you and them, you would always choose them, just because it's innate with the sacrifice that goes in becoming a parent. Or at least you'd like to think that's the case. But, you know, with this girl, like her dad or her mom, they don't even know that she's there. They don't know this is happening. And then some of the stats of 99% of people that are in human slavery or trafficked, they are never rescued. And that's just absolutely heartbreaking. So to me, I just, something about her story and just the sense of powerlessness and that she would give up anything to be free, and yet she can't be free, right? Or that the only way she could be free is if someone came and rescued her or there was a special situation. So to me, I think it's just seeing her powerlessness in that situation and knowing this is not a unique story. There are millions and millions and millions of other people. They're, you know, greater than the you know, three times the size of LA potentially, that are actually still in slavery around the world, which is just hard to believe. And in the US as well. So it's just hard to believe this is actually here and that, you know, we've allowed it, because I think we haven't, it's very uncomfortable. It's very challenging to try to actually deal with the reality of it. But this girl's story really broke my heart.
Got it. So I'm going to ask something that's slightly deeply personal, because this podcast, we ask deeply personal stuff. So you hear stories in New York and in LA of people going to these cities, to our cities, young girls, young men, whomever, right? Families seeking some level of greater resource, whatever that looks like, money, fame, status, whatever that dream is. They flock to these cities, and only a very few percentage make it. You know, it's the odds just are, there are millions of individuals that are in LA and New York following the dream. And in the remainder of those who do not, there is a subset of that are currently being trafficked. It's just the reality of life, right? That it's not just a international issue, which of course a movie like Taken almost lends itself to that sort of narrative. It's also something that just is happening in our backyards. We don't know it, we may know it, we may not, you know, these may not be the stories that make the news, but they're there. So how do you see your mission working as something that you want to do in LA, like, or in Jacksonville or in Atlanta? How do you see that mission not only working for those that are being trafficked globally, but that are also being trafficked in the spaces that you live and work in?
Yeah, it's a great question, because a lot of people, it's difficult. I think with hunger, you're like, okay, well, we're going to bring some food, or, you know, how do you actually identify trafficking and what do you do about it? I mean, if you work a job and you live in New York, or you live in LA, you're like, so let's stop this. Well, a lot of times we don't really see it when it's happening. We don't see, there's a lot of things that, sometimes, you know, workers that are paid under the table, there's trafficking involved with that. Sometimes even things that are kind of pop culture. So we talk about porn or strip clubs or prostitution. These places are very common where there's trafficking involved in these areas, and even in drugs and other things like that. So there's ways people will traffic individuals, but I think it starts with trying to learn more, you know, trying to find in every area there are organizations locally. I'm actually involved in an organization called Dressember. My younger sister actually started this organization. They've raised $20 million to help fight human trafficking. They give grants to local groups that do this, as well as International Justice Mission. I'm going to Guatemala to go kind of see what's happening, boots on the ground there. I think it's really the stories, because, right, this one story that I heard secondhand has been, you know, really the reason why, like, I've realized this is what I want to give my life to. And so I have some big financial goals. I think a lot of what I want to do is to generate some resources and really, maybe for one part of the world or one city or one area, say, you know, not in this city or not in this country or not in this area. Like, let's do everything we can to stop this. And, you know, this is, we're talking about the second most powerful, largest criminal, you know, force in the world. I mean, basically behind drugs. I mean, this is like $150 billion a year industry. And it's not something people just turn over and say, oh, we're just going to kind of let this go. It takes a lot of awareness. It takes a lot of intention. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of everything. And it takes people just caring when they see it and just saying, we're going to do everything we can to stop it. So I think this girl's story is really transformational, because for me, it made me say, hey, I like, that's a cause that's worth it. I mean, so many people are dying because they don't have a vision for their life. They're literally just like kind of existing. But, you know, is it worth dying for a cause? Yeah, I think it is. And I'm not saying I'm going to be a martyr or go and do whatever, but I think it's just in the point of living every day saying, let me keep this girl in mind. Let me keep people like her in mind and just be aware that it's happening around me.
Absolutely, man. Thank you for those points. All right. So let's kind of bring the conversation back and merge our two central points at this moment, right? So we talked about finances, financial literacy, resources, and we talked about human trafficking, right? So you made a point about parents, and I think this is a really interesting point, right? You said that the parents didn't know where this girl was, right? Or they might not have known, right? There's some disconnect between her family having the ability to access her, remove her from that circumstance, and bring her back home in whatever that capacity could have looked like, right? And so how do you see your mission of financial awareness, of resource awareness, overlay. Anyone who's listening to this, if you have a better word, please message me. Yeah,
convergence.
Like, no, yeah, it's not a convergence. It's literally a layering of, right? Because Okay. Because and maybe I'll just give you the broader point that I'm trying to make. Right? Like, as parents, fathers, mothers, as we become more financially literate, as we find ourselves in positions of having more opportunity, we then start to mitigate as much risk for our children as possible, right? Like we start to maybe not have to send our children across six countries in order to find a life for them, right? Or maybe we do, and we allow them to have options, right? But I think that there's something in the power of learning how to best create wealth that allows for opportunities that are truly beneficial, which then creates less of a opportunity for folks to be in positions where they are at a higher risk of being trafficked. I know that being trafficked is not something that people, I don't want to give this a walking down the alley in a short skirt scenario. That's not what I'm saying, but more so that the activities, the spaces, the opportunities that were led to become far more beneficial and less risky for us when our families are engaged in financial literacy, when our families have generational wealth to supply us with opportunities and jobs, where we don't have to go to LA at 12 hoping to be a movie star, because we understand that there are strategies and ways of providing a life for ourselves that isn't based in Hollywood or isn't based in Wall Street or isn't based in these institutions, that can be based in our own venture. What do you think about that? Break that down for me. I don't know if I articulated it correctly for the audience, but break down what you think I was saying and then give me whatever points you have for it.
Yeah. So I think what you were talking about, at least what I took from it, was just, yeah, how do we create a better life, or basically like a better culture or a better families? How do we empower people with financial literacy so they can have a better life, so we can prevent human trafficking, so we can stop it, so we can help people to prosper? And I think that's a great question. And that's why I also believe financial literacy is so, so, so important. A lot of people spend a lot of time working and then they don't spend any time reading books or educating themselves. I just recently discovered that the average CEO reads 60 books a year, and versus the average American reads 12 books a year. And there are 50% of people that read less than 4 books a year in the US, which is, you know, and I'm not saying it's just you have to read more, but when we read and we engage our mind, it allows all these doors to open. We get mentors from books. We get teachers. We can learn anything. A lot of finance is just learning the terms. I mean, again, I quote Robert Kiyosaki, who wrote Rich Dad Poor Dad. He said, the difference between the wealthy and the poor, a lot of times it's just the vocabulary that they use. If you can understand what return on equity means or what your cash on cash return is, I mean, that's really powerful. And those might seem like, well, what does that term mean? Well, maybe you should listen. You should Google it, go look it up, because that will help you with your financial education. But again, I think if we can educate our kids, we can educate our neighbors, we can educate friends and family, we can look at people that may be struggling and kind of help them on their journey, it will give them more tools and resources so they can be better off and hopefully not be in a place of just getting by or being just lower middle class, but they can be thriving and they can be a way to help bridge and be a resource for others.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good summarization of what I was getting to. I think the other thing that I was trying to hit is that oftentimes in the rich dad, poor dad scenario, right, is that a lot of what we learn about money, we learn from our parents, right? We look in role model their behaviors, right? And so when we start to equip parents with better financial decision-making, we then put their children and grandchildren in better situations just by performing role model behavior. My dad save, I'm going to save a little, right? My dad spent, I'm going to spend, right? And so the other part to, I think what I was getting at is just in changing one, you can then have this domino effect, the possibility of a domino effect of affecting that family and what that family's trajectory can look like.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, a lot of times we can look at it this way too, that, oh, you know, my family's not wealthy. I come from a poor family, or my parents are divorced, or I grew up in this situation. It was very difficult. And how could I ever become that? Because I didn't learn that from my parents. But we learned earlier, you know, that 88% of millionaires are self-made. So it's the idea of like the value of educating yourself. There's a guy named Brian Tracy, and he's a motivational speaker. He says, if you want to earn more, you got to learn more. And it's a very cliche kind of simple thing, but I think it's so, so true. The only thing that really separates you from earning more and be able to have maybe the house that you want, where you can have your family there, you can provide, or how do you live in LA where the average house is 1.5 million, or in New York City? Like, how do you do that with a family? Well, if you want to earn more, you gotta learn more. And so people that I've watched that are wealthy, they have certain habits that they do. And if you can do those things, you will become wealthy. And I think the part of that that's cool is that you can help teach your kids about this stuff, right? Because you can't, and a lot of people try to live kind of where they avoid money, or they'll say like, oh, money's just here. And in teaching, it's common. It's like, oh, I'm just going to do this, or I'm in service, something that helps people, which is great. And I was a pastor for a number of years, kind of years ago, and helped work with students. And I love that. I got paid.
Wait, pause. You were a pastor and you also were a medical salesman, and uh-huh. Now you're co-managing an equity.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. All right. I just wanted to make sure I understood that.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah.
Continue.
So it's interesting. So that, you know, when I approach people to invest, I mean, to me, I don't really care if people invest with us or with someone else. It's just, I feel like they'd be better off doing a certain type of investment. They'd be better off learning about these type of investments or learning how to educate themselves, right? Because at the end of the day, like, I'm trying to make an impact, and whether it's, you know, a small impact or a ginormous impact and we end human slavery, that's kind of up to God, right? I'm just going to do my part and do whatever I can. But I think that for most people, we look at kind of where we've come from, and anything that anybody else has, we can do those activities. We can learn from people, and then it can start to change in our family. So instead of coming from a really poor family, you say, hey, well, I'm actually learning these things and I'm becoming wealthy. I'm going to teach my kids this so that they can teach their kids, you know, and it becomes something that's like a generational blessing, right?
Sure. So I'm having an interesting time here, right? Because I want us to have a great conversation. I also feel like I want to dig into some things. And so I'm asking questions and making statements, and you guys who are listening know I do both. And I want to make sure that I'm going to ask this in a way that is answerable for you, right? Because I want you to be able to respond and articulate your thoughts. But I don't necessarily have the verbiage that I want to ask this in this moment. So I'm going to do the best that I can. So how do you see the balance of having a strong moral and ethical background in being a pastor with the complexities that it takes to be an investor?
Yeah.
Right. And because investors tend to it's you're really thinking about what's best. Actually, you know what? I'm gonna let you ride this as in the way that you want to.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, because it's as an investor, you're looking at, okay, what's the best return regardless of the investment or the implications in the world, right?
Yep.
And so it can be just the bottom line. It's all the bottom line. And we get that from corporate America, you know, these wealthy companies, they just do whatever they're going to do. And it's all about profit. It's all about profit. It's all about profit. Well, in my opinion, I think there's the idea of conscious investing or investing in a way that aligns with your value. So there's things that, you know, I don't invest in because I don't believe that they're, you know, things that make the society better, right?
Got
so
it.
I don't invest in companies that do payday loans. I don't invest in certain type of things that I feel have underhanded practices or things that are you know, on the eye of regulators. Now, the returns may be higher and people can go to those things and get higher returns, but I will say no because I'm investing both, you know, money in getting a return, obviously, so I can make a difference, but it's also investing in the right things, hoping that they succeed. So when we go into Jacksonville, we're going in and we renovate apartments and we make the community better. The other side of that is if somebody goes, now the downside of that is rents can become more expensive over time, right? It's just because of inflation, because of other things, or because you renovate. So that for some people, that could be a real struggle. And I've wrestled with that, right? But the other side of that is if somebody goes into an old apartment and they don't do anything and they let it get run down and there's shady characters there and now there's drug dealing on the property, whatever, well, that endangers the lives of everybody there. So I just think that, you know, the idea of really going in, trying to improve the community, work with tenants. But I mean, those are things that it's a great question because it's something that I really wrestle with. Like, how do you make the right difference you're trying to make and make an ethical profit and do something in a way? Because, you know, every company actually has to have profit. If you don't have profit in a company, it's like the oxygen for the company. So profits are not evil. They're necessary. And so how do we, you know, do something that we believe in that's actually making the right difference, creating value for the community? And I believe if you do that, you're going to get paid and you should get paid well. So that's my opinion.
All right, cool. So 1 Timothy 6:10, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. What do you say to folks who come to you with that mentality? Like, what's your conversation with them? Because there's a lot of folks that's their mentality. And it there's a spectrum of wealthiness that believes that, right? Like, it's not just a poor person that would say that statement, right? There are individuals who are materially wealthy that will also say, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. So what do you say to folks that's their sort of guiding philosophy, or maybe that's a philosophy that they lean into when discussing earning and scaling your wealth?
So I love that you shared that. I actually spoke at this conference in Phoenix last week and I brought that up, right? Because I was raised in a family of teachers, a religious family. And sometimes it was misquoted, or at least I misunderstood it, that this verse said, you know, that money is the root of all evil, right? Or all kinds
Most
of
people
evil.
Misquote and, the quote as money yeah. is the root of all evil. Absolutely.
Right. Money is the root of all evil. But the idea that, you know, the love of money, and I think of it, it's true. You know, if you love money more than you love people, if you love money or, you know, what money will give you more than you love, I mean, a lot of it, I think it basically just shows that that is the most important thing. And you see that. You see people make trade-offs where they will backstab in business. They will cheat people. They will lie. They will do anything to get ahead because the money itself really becomes like a god, right? That it will provide everything for you in life. It will give you everything that you want. But I think, you know, if you look at it and you say, hey, and nobody's immune to greed, right? I'm not immune to greed. You're not, nobody's immune to it. So anybody who says they're immune to it, you'd be suspect of them, right? Because we're all suspect to it. But I think the idea that money is simply a tool, that it's money is neither good or evil. It's just something that's value. And, you know, there's, and we're quoting verses, Bible verses, but the idea that like whoever's given much, much more will be required. Or if you're faithful with little, you'll be given much. And even you look at that parable where it talks about, here, you've been faithful with this small matter. Here, come take charge of 10 cities. So I look at like a stewardship thing, right? How am I going to manage the money that I have? If you haven't managed your money well, who's going to give you their money to manage, right? It's just not going to happen. But it's, I think that, you know, money to me is, it's the ability to be generous. There's a lot of, actually, if you want to go deeper on that, I've got a lot of stuff when it comes to entrepreneurship and faith and all that. I've got some examples from the Bible, but I know everybody's not, you know, I love that you quoted that, but I just don't know how deep you want to go on that. But anyway, I have a lot of thoughts on that.
All right, cool. Or we could also quote Uncle Ben, who said, with great power comes great responsibility, right? Like for you younger guys, for you non-secular folks. So I want to get back to your story and your journey. So we now know what you're passionate about. You sort of went through, I think, a quick and fast sort of introduction of how you got to the place that you're in. You said you met a guy and they said, hey, you should do this more. And you were like, great, right? So why don't you go through that journey a bit more for the folks who are thinking about scaling their capacity for investment, that are thinking about using passive investment as a means and strategy, right? Who are considering, who never heard the term syndication before. This is their first time hearing it. And I imagine there was a time where that was your first time hearing it, right? And so so what got you from being a traditional kind of transactional salesperson to being in the space where you're managing this much wealth?
Right. So I think the first question people have to ask is, you know, do I have time or do I have money? And there are two different questions, right? If somebody's wealthy and they're, you know, been, you know, working for a while and they've got a fair amount of money and they're saying, where do I put my money? Then that's a great maybe choice to passively invest or learn about passive investing. And there's multifamily, there's self-storage, there's ATM machines, there's all kinds of different alternative stuff you've never heard of. And there's lots of different opportunities there. But if somebody has more time than they have money, and actually when I started, I had neither, I felt like I had a good job, but I didn't have a lot of money saved up. So what I did is I just made the time. And I just said, I'm going to read every book on this I can. I'm going to start a meetup, which I did in Pasadena. And we've got a meetup that's been going for 4 years now, once a month. And I just really tried to create value around that. So how I got my start, I started this meetup with a partner. We had 60 people at the first meeting. A guy came up to me I'd never met before and said, hey, I'd invest in one of your multifamily deals. And I was thinking like, I don't have a deal, but I got coffee with him. And I gave him a sample deal, right? This is what a deal would look like. I said, you know, would this be interesting to you? And he said, yeah. And he said, I'd invest $100,000 in something like that. So I basically took that knowledge and I went to another guy who came to that same meetup who I met for the first time. And he was raising money for a deal. He was raising $3 million for a multifamily property in Texas. So I introduced the two of them. So that was then my first experience getting my first deal done and being a general partner, which is more on the active side. So again, there's active and there's passive. But going from zero to one is the hardest, right? Going from, hey, I'm thinking about, there's a lot of people kicking tires, but until you actually get in and you're actually doing a deal, that's the hardest thing. And then once you get into that, then it's like, oh, you're somebody who does this. Then your family looks at you differently. The real estate community looks at you differently and things open up. So I would say if somebody's interested in passively investing, you can research groups like ours or other groups that do deals and you can get on their investor list for deals. If somebody's more interested in being active, go to conferences or local meetups and just try to meet people and ask questions and just be curious. You know, try to ask what's your biggest failure you made, not just what your biggest, what's the biggest thing you did wrong? What advice would you give to your younger self? And those are, you know, people are very willing to help others in the real estate community if you approach it with a humble attitude.
Thanks for that, man. What's your thoughts around using LinkedIn to prospect? I know a lot of folks who are like, man, I'm going to create this investment group to invest in multifamilies and I'm going to find them on LinkedIn. How do you feel about that trend? Just kind of a random question, but it's something that I hear a lot of. Like folks are really looking for, don't know the success rates, right? But looking for these sort of meetup groups to occur in virtual spaces like LinkedIn in order for them to find the core of their investment group. What do you think about that strategy?
Yeah, so I think LinkedIn can be great. I mean, if you're willing to do the work, or you can even hire people to, you know, that are overseas. Upwork is a site where you can hire people that are overseas to do little tasks, or you actually have people that are sit pro. There's actually really advanced systems that will, you know, $100 a month, and they'll send out messages for you, like kind of appearing to be you. Hey, are you interested in this? And they have set responses. But I get a lot of that on LinkedIn. So I know there's a lot of people doing that. So the approach that I've really gone, it does use LinkedIn. It does use Facebook, because my typical investor is 40 to 70 years old, and they're on Facebook and they're on LinkedIn. So what I do is I create a lot of content. I do, obviously, I'm on guests on podcasts. I have my own podcast. I post a lot on LinkedIn. I post on Facebook. And I think if you're somebody who's just on there posting stuff about the topic that you're interested in, if it's real estate, if it's multifamily, if it's self-storage, whatever it is, people are going to start to reach out. And I've watched that if you're adding value, people, you add value first, and then, you know, you're doing this on this show. And so I'm not sure what your next steps are. People are going to reach out, right? If they're interested in following you, they're going to find out, and you'll have some way to connect with them on a deeper level, or you have some service that you do. So that's kind of how we do it. So how we've raised, I think $7 million this year so far has just been through creating content and networking. And you can do kind of cold email or cold message on LinkedIn. But I think if you're someone who just continually creates content, you do it consistently. That's the thing. You have to do it consistently. If you're consistent about creating, you know, having a content creator, you have a show, you can't do it every once in a while. You got to be consistent. And that's where people really start to follow.
Nice, man. Thank you. All right. So we are coming to the close, man. This was a fast hour. I don't know if it felt like an hour, but this time seemed to have flown by. All right. So I ask two questions at the close of every episode before inviting you to give us the audience and myself a way to contact you if we want to engage in your material, in your content, or potentially invest, right? But let me get to the two questions first. The first question is, on any streaming platform, what's something that you have recently watched that you thoroughly enjoyed?
On any streaming platform, meaning it could be a show.
It could be a show. It could be a movie. It could be on, you know, YouTube. It could be on Netflix. Yeah. Wherever you want. Yeah. Wherever you like.
Yeah. So I'm kind of a Star Wars nerd. So I just watched the Obi-Wan. I think it was the third episode came out, and I loved it. It was really fun. And once even Ewan McGregor, you know, kind of reprised that role, which is fun. So I love watching Star Wars.
All right. So we're talking about Disney Plus. We're talking about the Obi-Wan series. I believe the Obi-Wan series is the third in this kind of Star Wars streaming platform offering. I know there's The Mandalorian, and then there is
Boba Fett.
Boba Fett. Yeah, the Book of Boba Fett, right? The Book of Boba Fett, right? And so you have this kind of offering, and I watched the first three episodes. I thought it was awesome. I think that there's some folks that have some continuity questions, some, you know, why didn't this happen if that happened? I think if you become an enjoyer of the media and you kind of let the story unfold for you rather than trying to anticipate or deconstruct too early, you'll have a really great time with it, right? But if you're like, why didn't he tell Leia that her brother was over there? Like, then you're gonna spend so much time in the muck of trying to get the continuity organized and being that guy that you may miss out on some really great programming.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think it's, I love watching a good show. I just watched the new Top Gun this weekend. I loved it. Thought that was a great show. And the problem is there's so much good content out there that like you can just never do anything and watch TV all the time and never even scratch the surface on what's out there. So.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So the second question is sort of similar to the first, right? So on any streaming platform, what's something that you thoroughly enjoy that if I polled the folks that know you, they wouldn't think that that's what you enjoy, right? So maybe folks know you and know that you're a Star Wars fan, right? But maybe they don't know that you like to watch this. And this sort of content you thoroughly enjoy, but, you know, may not necessarily be what's top of mind for folks that know you?
Yeah, that's a good question. Honestly, I left my corporate job about a year ago. I'd been doing this for, you know, several years before that, but I was able to leave my job. And then there's this saying that you can quit working a job 40 hours, you know, for someone else to go work like 60 plus hours, you know, for yourself. So it can be like, you know, just the idea. So I spent a lot of time reading. I don't watch, I mean, I hate to say, I don't watch a lot of shows. I kind of nerd out on the Star Wars stuff. But I'm trying to think of a show. I really, for a while, this was kind of way back, but I really got into the 24 series years ago. And just, I don't know if you've watched the show with Kiefer Sutherland, where it's, you know, every hour is an hour of the day. And, you know, the bomb is going to go off and kill the entire, you know, White House staff. You know, everything's going to be terrible. So I like just the suspense of that. I think a lot of people probably wouldn't expect that I like action stuff as much as I do, but I love it.
True. I mean, I think that there was a really strong period of time where those sorts of action thrillers were just prevalent, right? Like you, it was like when the beginning of The Blacklist, right? The end of 24, like they tried to make another one, but it didn't really catch like they thought it would, right? But you had these shows, right? Like 24, I think House was out around then. You just had these kind of really, really interesting shows. And then we moved somewhere. I don't know where we are right now, but we're not in the era of great scripted action on traditional TV. Do you think that's because the proliferation of the Netflix and the Hulus and the Disney Plus and all of these have now kind of had a monopoly on delivering this level of content where the networks just don't have that same capacity? Like, where's the shift? Because you mentioned 24, and that was a great era, not just of the show, but of TV offering in general. And it's just, it's not the same. So what happened? What do you think happened?
So I went to a conference recently where there was a bunch of YouTubers there that have millions of subscribers on YouTube. And they put it, one guy from YouTube actually came and put up a picture, an image on the screen that showed, you know, traditionally people now that are watching cable television, it's like 2 to 3% of all the media that's being watched. And then things like YouTube and things like Apple TV and Netflix and all this stuff is like, it's pushed all to that. And I think because there's such a competitive thing of trying to create more and do more. And now it's great for consumers because there's so many good things out there. I mean, there's so many good shows on so many different outlets that, in the future, that's why I'm, you know, and I know you are as well, you're creating content. And I love YouTube in general because it kind of lives on there forever, right? Now people may not get to it right away, but over time, as things grow, more people find your stuff and they haven't quite figured out how to pay, you know, advertising. There's a little bit of advertising people get, but I think it's just, things are very, very, they're shifting a lot away from traditional television to on demand and even, you know, creator comment, you know, stuff from podcasts to videos to education to academies online. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that's happening. I think it's just a major, major transition right now.
All right. Last question. This is not one of my two, but I think this is an interesting question because I find you to be an interesting guest. So what do you think the future of learning through books will be, right? Like, do you think that ebooks will start to outpace how individuals are consuming? And do you still believe in long form book presentation? Like, do you think it's about shorter, more impactful books, or are you still a fan of the longer kind of full book offering?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I personally like physical books. I do have a Kindle, I have ebook stuff. Most people read less. I think there's a lot of learning that happens through YouTube, which is great, and through other sources. I mean, you can YouTube how to change a tire on this car, specific car, or how to do this certain thing that, or cook this recipe. You can search anything, you can find anything, right? It's all available there. But I think what we miss with that is we miss some of the really, really good authors that wrote a book 100 years ago, or wrote a book 20 years ago, or 50 years ago. And, you know, it can take somebody, you know, 1,000 hours to write a book, or a couple thousand hours to write a book. So if it takes you 5 hours to read it, you're getting an incredible return on your time, right? This person researched this, they read multiple books, they're an expert in that field, and they're teaching you about something. I think it's something that's, it's kind of a lost art in a way, but I do think that people I don't know. That, you know, that's a really good question. Will people continue to read? I mean, I think the more medias are out there, probably it'll be less, or there'll be other adaptive ways to read. But I mean, technology keeps finding a way to take over. Even audiobooks. I do tons of my reading on audiobooks, and you can speed them up, you can slow it down, you can repeat it, you can do it while you run, you can do it while you work out or drive or whatever you're doing. So I think that you know, if it's about the information, I, you know, maybe eventually it'll be like the Matrix, where it was just like, you know, he gets the thing out of the back of his head and says, "I know Kung Fu." You know, it'll be like that. We just know whatever it is. But yeah, I do think the learning is incredibly valuable. And I think if we're only looking at media and things today, we miss out on the history. We miss out on how things looked 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, which everything, it doesn't necessarily repeat, but it all rhymes. And so stuff has happened. Everything that's happened now has happened before in different ways, right? So it's really important. I think people look back. And yeah, so I think it's good.
Yeah, listen, right? Folks said that radio was gone and then podcasts happened. And people are like, oh, I like listening to stuff again, right? Or folks are like, hey, you know, I don't, video is silly, right? There was a moment where like the idea of like video was just a reflection of like DVDs and VHS. And now video has a very clear value to folks, right? Because it's been frameworked in a different way. I was just interested to hear about books, because as YouTube, as forums proliferate, right? So I can have a Discord where I'm talking to experts about ideas, and I don't actually need to write about the idea. I can just Discord with individuals about the idea. Like, where does that put books, right? Because as we start to engage in more media, specifically more digital visual media, right? I see a world where we start to rely less on books, more specifically because books aren't really a social experience, right? Like book right. clubs may be social, but books are kind of intimate. And folks, sorry, audience, I don't know if y'all really want to be intimate. Like, I think you like to do things and know that a million other people also did that thing, right? For you to deem it as being valuable and worthy of engagement. And so, you know, I hope books find their space in evolution and innovation, because, you know, the sensory experience of turning a page, of opening a book, of putting a bookmark or creasing a page to find where you were before, that's something that, you know, is tactile, and it creates connection and intimacy, and you know, that's something that you definitely don't want to lose as a part of the reading experience.
Right.
All right, cool. Man, Bronson, listen, why don't you tell us, how do we have a conversation with you? Listen, I want to talk to you about investment. I want to learn where your content is on LinkedIn or on YouTube, right? Where am I finding information about you so that I can engage with you in a purposeful way?
Yeah, so I created this report called The Single Best Investing Strategy During and After a Pandemic. It's 24 color pages. I'm actually in the process of finalizing one about how to take advantage of inflation. And both of those you can find at my website. They're free giveaways. It's bronsonequity.com. There's also a way you can join if you're interested in hearing about our upcoming deals. We'd love to have conversations about that. Or if you just want to shoot me an email, it's bronson@bronsonequity.com. So if you're interested in, hey, I'm interested in doing this myself, what do you think? I'd love to chat and any way I can add value. So, yeah.
All right, cool. So listen, guys, there you have it. We spoke with Bronson of Bronson Equity, and we had a conversation that was all over the place in the best way possible. We talked about passion. We talked about investment. We talked about active versus passive investment. We talked about Pareto's principle. We talked about rich dad, poor dad. We talked about the atrocities of human trafficking. And we found out that he's an avid fan of Star Wars. What more is there to know about this man? Listen, if you want to find out more about him, please follow up. Go to the website, engage in the material on social networks. Otherwise, I'm Dion Brown. This is Man vs. Brand. Bronson, I appreciate your time in talking with us, man. It was a great conversation. I appreciate you, audience, for listening in and tuning in each week. And I hope that above all else, these conversations are bringing you guys value so that you can share this with your loved ones, your family, your friends, your network. That's Dion Brown. Love you guys. We'll talk to you soon. Have a great day. Bye.
If this talk just resonated with you or could help someone you know, follow Dion or his guest on all social media platforms. Till next time, and remember, with any business or brand, give it your heart, make it real, or else forget about it. See you all soon.